This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. For 50 years, Anthony Lewis's words, wit, and wisdom have more than graced the pages of the New York Times. He's the consummate journalist who has seen it all, Vietnam, apartheid, 9/11, and he has challenged us all. Last week, Anthony Lewis wrote his last op-ed column, but he still has plenty to say about his beloved country. In this hour, Anthony Lewis in his own words. But first, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has returned from a whirlwind trip this week that took him from the Caucasus to Afghanistan and finally to a NATO meeting in Brussels. Vernon Loeb, a reporter with The Washington Post, traveled with the Secretary of Defense. I asked him about the big stops and agenda items on Rumsfeld's itinerary.
Well, the biggest stop was clearly his surprise visit to Bagram Air Base, about 30 miles north of Kabul. On Sunday, it was quite dramatic, really. If somebody had told me back on October 7th when the air war started that I'd be going with Rumsfeld to Bagram Air Base in mid-December, I would have said, no way.
With no shells flying.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Liberated Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So it was quite a sight to see him, you know, walk off this C-17 transport plane and be surrounded by, Afghan freedom fighters with AK-47s, mm-hmm. and one guy had a rocket-propelled grenade, you know, slung over his shoulder.
It's a striking image. Did he have an agenda there?
He spent about a couple of hours talking to Hamid Karzai, the new interim prime minister, and Fahim Khan, the new interim defense minister. You know, he said he thought it was useful for him to get to know them and for them to get to know him. But to me, it was clearly kind of a symbolic trip. It almost seemed like a victory lap.
Mm-hmm. A symbolic moment in a huge trip. Where else was he landing and with what kind of agenda?
Well, he started his trip on Saturday in the Caucasus, where he visited Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Georgia in sort of whirlwind fashion. That leg of the trip was really to kind of shore up relationships with kind of emerging allies or new allies in the war on terrorism, both Azerbaijan and Armenia, traditional rivals, of course, immediately offered any assistance they could provide in the war. And I think both have thus far offered, you know, overflight rights and increased intelligence cooperation. We were taken to a major U.S. base in the region, and it was incredible. I can't exactly tell you where I was when we went to a major U.S. base near Afghanistan. Those were the ground rules for this trip to this base. It was incredible, the amount of American supplies and personnel and equipment on the ground in this place is, it really, really kind of underscored the commitment
scale
the U.S. military has to the war in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking, you know, more than 1,000 soldiers. There were at least half a dozen to a dozen airplanes on the ground, helicopters, mechanics, pallets of supplies everywhere. I mean, they're creating a little American city out there from which they're executing this war.
Do you have a sense of, on these sort of what have been frontline states in the Afghan war, of how Rumsfeld is thinking about their performance and what, if anything, they're now asking of the United States?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. What exactly we're offering them for their cooperation is one of the things we really don't know from this war. And Rumsfeld, from the get-go, has been very reluctant to describe exactly what countries are offering us, thus the ground rules on this trip. You know, we'll take you to this base, but you can't say where it is, out of deference to sensitivities related to the home country. His line all along has been, we're asking everybody for as much help as they can give us, but we're gonna leave it up to them to characterize that help and to publicly explain, you know, the extent to which they're helping us. So it's one of the unknowns of this war. You know, clearly we're getting a lot of help from Pakistan. We know we're getting help from Uzbekistan. Tajikistan has offered help. You know, we've been flying missions out of Oman. So we really have relied on a lot of basing in the region. And what we're giving them in return, I don't know. I assume there's some form of assistance, future cooperation. I think we've already talked to Pakistan about military parts and equipment now that sanctions have been lifted off them. So that's one of the things that remains to be seen. But we're clearly getting a lot of help in the region from countries around Afghanistan, and that's been essential to fight this war.
The Secretary of Defense ended up his trip at the NATO meeting in Brussels. What was his reception? reception there?
He seemed to be warmly received, and I mean, he was clearly the star of the show. I mean, Rumsfeld has taken on sort of rock star proportions, and I think that was very, very evident at NATO when he came out to brief this large auditorium where the press briefings go on, you know, immediately filled up. So I think he was, you know, he was the star of the show.
Vernon Loeb, any sense along the way in this long trip of where this war on terror might turn next militarily?
I think no, and I think that's because it's really not at all clear. I certainly don't think there's going to be another major military action anytime soon to rival in scope or importance the one that we've been waging in Afghanistan. In fact, Rumsfeld has been sort of clear to say, you know, don't think in terms of phase one and phase two, and don't think that Afghanistan alone has been phase one. He's repeatedly emphasized that there's all sorts of things happening all around the world, Afghanistan just being the most visible and the most, you know, military among them.
But if a next step would not be on the scale of Afghanistan or greater, that would seem to rule out Iraq for the time being.
Well, I think, I would rule out Iraq for the time being. Yeah, I think we're at least months away before any major military action would start in Iraq. I think what you're going to see are the kinds of things we just saw in Yemen, where the Yemeni government went after a couple of al-Qaeda camps and shut them down. I think you're going to start to see little raids like that happening in places like Yemen and the Sudan and Somalia.
Vernon Loeb, you've had a long week on the road. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Vernon Loeb is a reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Tonight's guest, New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis, doesn't mince words. Instead, he uses them to get to the heart of world issues and America's conscience. For 32 years, his column, Abroad at Home, provoked, prodded, and shaped a national dialogue about decency, humanity, and reason. What do you think is the state of America's conversation with itself today? What are you looking for from opinion makers in these uncertain times? You can join our conversation with Anthony Lewis tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Martha's Vineyard is Anthony Lewis. Good evening, Mr. Lewis.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
And also with us from Vermont Public Radio is special coverage news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Anthony Lewis, we're still getting used to the idea of a world without your column. We're not sure that we like it. How does it feel for you to be leaving in the midst of yet another American global crisis?
Well, when I decided to retire, which was months ago, the date was fixed at the end of this year, I had no idea that we would have September 11, of course, or that we would have the actions that President Bush and Attorney General Ashcroft have taken that alarm me. So that's just the way it is. You have to stop sometime, and that's it.
It's been such a career, and we've got a lot we want to talk about tonight, spanning the Vietnam era. You were so involved in the global debate over apartheid. You've always kept your eye keenly on the law and America's conscience around the law. I'd be grateful to sort of set the tone for us tonight if you would be good enough to read a little bit from a column of yours that ran on May 1st, 1970, following the U.S. invasion of Cambodia in the midst of the Vietnam War. I'm told this is among your favorite columns. Many people may remember it well. Would you be good enough to read something from that column?
I will. It began as follows. The headline on the column, and we write our headlines, columnists at the Times, was Cry the Beloved Country. American students are told that they must respect institutions. Their president deplores what he calls mindless attacks on all the great institutions which have been created by free civilizations. But the same president orders a massive armed attack in a foreign country without going through the procedures laid down by the Constitution for making war. The students are told that it is wrong to be cynical about democracy, but they see the man who campaigned on a pledge to get America out of the Vietnam War enlarging that war. This is not an invasion of Cambodia, President Nixon said. If the young judge those who run American society by the standard of truth in that statement, should anyone be surprised at cynicism? It has been hard for most of us middle-class, middle-aged Americans of liberal instinct to accept the apocalyptic vision of many students. we believed in reason. But the president's course in Cambodia would make the most optimistic rationalist despair for his country.
From May 1st, 1970, in a column entitled Cry, the Beloved Country, Anthony Lewis, set the table for us. How have you seen your mission as you've come to the keyboard week after week over all these years? How have you come to define it in that time?
Well, you know, I began writing columns rather suddenly in 1969 and never thought about it in terms of sketching out a mission or something like that. I think my deepest instincts were what informed what I decided to write about and the way I wrote. I have a very strong feeling for law, not only in general, but specifically as the absolute essential of the United States. I think our experience in the world over the last 50 years tells us that societies succeed in being relatively decent, humane, civilized, to the extent that law informs public policy and that people stick to what the law requires. We've had a great expansion in constitutional democracy, the prime example in my life, I think, being South Africa, going from the racist, lawless state it was, where the law was perverted for racist purposes, to a state with a very strong constitution and a wonderful constitutional court and a president, the first president of the new South Africa, Nelson Mandela, who was absolutely committed to that constitution and the law. So those are the things that have really been the markers for me.
And at the same time, you were never afraid of the issues of conscience that surround the law. Jack Beattie, many of us began to read Anthony Lewis very closely during the Vietnam War, and I know you've picked out a favorite excerpt from a column written around the time of the Christmas Day bombing. Could you read some of that for us?
Yeah, the situation here was that the United States broke off negotiations with the Vietnamese in Paris and embarked on a 12-day bombing campaign around Christmas 1972. President Nixon told Admiral Moore, who was his chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he said, "I don't want any more of this crap about the fact that we couldn't hit this target or that one. This is your chance to use military power to win the war." Mm. 1,600 civilians were killed in the 12 days, 93 American airmen captured or killed. It accomplished nothing. This is Anthony Lewis, Goodwill to Men, a column appearing on Christmas Day, 1972. "The only blessing we can really hope for on Christmas is self-perception. Miracles are not to be expected. Only the chance of seeing on the symbol of Christmas to look within and see who we are. Of seizing on the symbol of Christmas. That was what the spirits did for Scrooge in one night. On this Christmas, Americans inescapably think of Vietnam. It is a Christmas of horrors. The Red River Delta of North Vietnam is one of the most populous areas on Earth. On any road, there is an endless stream of peasants bicycling along or walking with baskets balanced on poles over their shoulders. For the last week, the week before Christmas 1972, American planes have been bombing the villages and towns of the Red River Delta day and night. Their mission, in the words of the leading French newspaper Le Monde, is terror. This is what Americans will see this Christmas if, like the redeemed Scrooge, they looked honestly into themselves. Many millions of Americans do understand and are tortured by their apparent inability to stop their government's madness. But it hardly needs to be said that those who need salvation the most, the men who hold power, will not listen to the spirits in the night. By now, they have to be reckoned men without humanity. They talk about football while arranging to impose on little countries that thwart them the punishment of mass death. In the sentimental myth, Christmas is a time of forgiveness, but only saints can forgive mass murder. For some Americans, for many, it sticks in the throat this Christmas to say, God bless us, everyone."
Jack Beattie, we just have 20 seconds before the break. Your response to that powerful writing?
Well, that has stayed in my mind almost word for word all those years. It spoke for the conscience of this country. That is what Anthony Lewis has done throughout his career. There is no one to replace him.
We're talking tonight with Anthony Lewis. He's retiring from his column at the New York Times after 32 years there, all after a half a century at the Times. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. What do you think of the state of America's conversation with itself? This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Anthony Lewis. Just last week, he wrote his last column for the New York Times after 50 years with the Times, 32 years on the op-ed page. Always a champion of law, of the Constitution, of decency, humanity, and reason. You can join our conversation with Anthony Lewis tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you think of the state of America's conversation with itself? Anthony Lewis, we want to walk back through some of the main chapters in the long, long career that you shared with all of us. But before we do that, what are the big issues on your mind as you write that last column, as you give your parting messages on that page?
Well, of course, at the moment, I think I'm concerned about the abuse of the law in the way Attorney General Ashcroft has held aliens indefinitely, is proposing to convict people on the basis of secret evidence and other things that seem to me to stray from American understanding and constitutional rights. It's always there's always a tendency to do that in times of stress and war, and it's very much the case now, as I said in the column.
Are you confident in the self-righting characteristics of America's democracy and relationship with the Constitution?
I'd have to say I'm confident up to a point. One thing I said in the column is that we've been lucky over most of our history in this country by being invulnerable or relatively invulnerable. We were scared, but we never really were threatened our national being. Now we've discovered that a small band of people, ruthless psychopaths, I would say, can kill thousands of Americans and strike fear into us. And just, if you think about the possibility of their getting weapons of mass destruction, that we feel logically more vulnerable than we've ever been. And the question is whether we will have the self-confidence that makes, civil liberties possible. We've been a self-confident country much of the time, most of the time, and that makes a big difference.
And with the fundamental change you describe, with this new sense of vulnerability, and I guess everybody agrees that in its extent it really does feel new, are you confident down to your toes that we've still got the right constitution for this age?
Oh, absolutely. The people who set us out on this path in 1787 were probably the greatest collection of political visionaries and serious thinkers that has ever been together, the framers of the Constitution. And the fact that their work has lasted as long as it has and done so much good, I think, speaks for itself. I'm quite confident in that.
Jack Beatty, Anthony Lewis has written for a long time about the exercise of power and its interaction with the Constitution and American law. You've got a recollection of a Saturday Night Massacre column during the Nixon administration when Richard Nixon engineered the ouster of Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox. I'd love you to raise that, and we can then look at what's going on today.
Yeah, the column begins by detailing a call that the acting Attorney General, William Ruckelshaus, received from General Haig, who was then the chief of staff to President Nixon. And General Haig said he said to fire the special prosecutor. Ruckelshaus refused, and then General Haig said, "Your commander-in-chief has given you an order." Now I quote from Anthony Lewis, the column as the end begins. "There it was, naked. The belief that the president reigns and rules, that loyalty runs to his person rather than to laws and institutions. It is precisely the concept of power against which Americans rebelled in 1776, and that they designed the Constitution to bar forever in this country. It is, in fact, a form of power that no English monarch has exercised since George III. General Haig's military phrase was significant in another sense also. Over this extraordinary weekend, Washington had the smell of an attempted coup d'etat. Like the plotters in a novel, Mr. Nixon and his men invoked threats abroad. They skillfully enlisted political elders enfeebled by years of subservience. They tried to cut out the judges, the lawyers, the constitutionalists. They sent the police to steal the dangerous files. But short of a real military coup, the attempt has failed. Most important, the issue facing this country country has been made so clear that no one with eyes to see can avoid it any longer. That issue is the legitimacy of this president.
From Anthony Lewis, his column after the Saturday night massacre during the Nixon administration. Jack Beatty, is there an analog or fear of an analog to ask Anthony Lewis about tonight?
Well, Tom, you had raised this question out of an interview he did in the New York Times. And in that, Tony, you said that while you believed in reason, you don't believe now in progress, that has been a change in your mind over these 30 years. Can you say what's made that change and what the significance of that is?
Well, I just meant the theory of progress that was alive at the beginning of this century, that everything was going to get better and better, we were getting wiser, and humanity was bound to gain. Well, after a century in which the Holocaust occurred, and after the Holocaust, we failed to stop the genocide in Bosnia or Rwanda, you can't really be that optimistic about progress. All you can do is try to stick as closely as you can to the rules and to the decencies and the humanity. Could I intervene with something here?
Please, please.
Both of you? I'm a little embarrassed at all the kind things you've said about me, and I'm grateful for them, and I wouldn't take back a word of that column, the bits of which Jack just read.
Mm.
But I don't want you to make a life in journalism look all heavy and, what should we say, anguished, because actually journalism is a hell of a good, fun profession, as I'm sure Jack would agree. And I've just had a wonderful time all over the world doing things. And part of it has been, even bad news, and there's been a lot of good news among it, and South Africa certainly very much at the forefront. I've had a notion that some of the great unfinished business of political strife over the world could get settled. And there were three places I had in mind.
Hmm.
Ireland, the Middle East, and South Africa. Those were the three places I thought really rationality could prevail, because there was a solution in each case that seemed like the right thing. Well,
so give us your scorecard, Anthony Lewis.
Scorecard is 100% in South Africa. Hmm. It's a constitutional republic now. Ireland, Northern Ireland, really gaining on it, close to a solution, and I think essentially the men with the guns have been shown the way out, and the public doesn't want them, and somehow it's going to work. The Middle East is a disaster. It was a close thing, and it's a failure of leadership. That's the lesson. There's another lesson in all these years, is that even though I'm a great believer in democracy and in the role of law, judges, and constitutions, political leaders make an immense difference. The accident, if that is what it was, of having a man of the character of Nelson Mandela at the time and place he was, just made all the difference in having a relatively peaceful transition. Could I tell a little story about Mandela?
Please do. We're always happy to hear that one.
Well, I met him, my wife and I met him for the first time about a month after he got out of prison. And I said to him, how are you going to arrange to try the people who did these terrible things to your people in South Africa? And he looked at me as if I were crazy. He said, try? We don't want to have trials of people. That would just tear this country apart. We have to learn to get along together, and revenge would be the worst thing we could possibly do. I was just stunned, and I think there are very few people in his position. After all, he had just finished 27 years in prison who would have taken that view, and what a difference it made.
What a difference, indeed. Anthony Lewis, we'll lift a glass with you to the joys of journalism, especially when things go well, and they do go well sometimes, and we take note of that with you in Ireland and South Africa. We have callers who want to join this conversation. Let's invite them in. We're at 1-800-423-8255, talking with two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and columnist Anthony Lewis, who reminds us that in spite of all the big and heavy issues, there's a lot of fun in this career, too. Steve is on the line from Amherst, New Hampshire. Hello, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
We're well, thank you.
Thanks very much for the program, and there's no one other than Anthony Lewis who would get me to make a cell phone call.
Glad to have you.
Anyway, my question is this. We've been through so many nomination processes where the conservatives have told us that the Constitution is a doctrine that needs to be unchanging. And, of course, in this circumstance, we've got a conservative who tells us that the Constitution needs to change quite dramatically. On the one hand, I can see opposing that, and I agree with you in the way that in which you have opposed it. On the other hand, what happened on September 11th seems to be wholly outside the prospect of what the framers could have envisioned for our country. It's a different time, it's a different method, it's a different expediency. Is there any way in which you could imagine an Attorney General of the United States justifying the actions that are being taken?
Steve, thanks for your call. Let's put it to Anthony Lewis.
Steve, let me say first that you make me think of attorneys general that I covered as a journalist before I became a columnist. One comes to mind. That was Ed Levy, who was President Ford's attorney general. He'd been the president of the University of Chicago and the dean of its law school. A man of the highest character and fealty to the law. I think if he were in the position now, he would understand the need for strong action. But he would build it on a foundation of respect for the Constitution. And the reason I feel so strongly about it is not just some sort of stick-in-the-mud worship of old things, but because that's the American character that the law respects. The world respects. Mm. And if we are true to ourselves, true to that history and that faith in the Constitution, then we're going to have the kind of impact in the world we should. Notice how the world has reacted to the idea of military tribunals. All of our friends and allies, from Spain to Britain to France to Germany, were horrified by the idea because that isn't their view of what America is. So I feel strongly that it was a mistake.
And I guess that goes to your assessment of John Ashcroft and maybe by extension to President George W. Bush.
I think President Bush was served up with some shortcut ideas, and he signed a hastily drafted executive order setting up these tribunals. I say hastily drafted, sloppily drafted, because it was so full of ununderstandable clauses, and it's in fact been ignored so far by the very administration that wrote it. The first two cases they brought before civilian courts, or the second one, which is the American who was fighting with the Taliban. They've said they will not use a military tribunal for him because they've realized belatedly that these military tribunals are not such a hot idea.
So has the threat passed then? Of
I don't think so, because I don't like the idea of executive orders lying around under which potentially 20 million foreign citizens in this country, those are people who came here as immigrants and are waiting to become citizens or visitors and other aliens here, 20 million of them. I think it's a terrible idea to have hanging over them the possibility of their suddenly being hauled before a military tribunal because someone says they had something to do with terrorism.
We're talking tonight with Anthony Lewis. He's hanging up his columnist spurs after 32 years with one column and 50 years with the New York Times. What do you think of the state of America's conversation with itself, our respect for law, for decency? How do you feel about the state of America's civil rights? You can join the conversation with Anthony Lewis at 1-800-423-8255. Alvin is on the line. Hello, Alvin. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Good to talk to Mr. Lewis. I've had a long sort of indirect history with Ms. Lewis. Back in the 1960s, I was a student at Brooklyn College, and I was assisting a blind professor, Samuel Konevsky, who taught constitutional law at the time.
I well remember him.
Good. And one of the things I used to do was read him the New York Times each morning. And the first thing we did each morning was to read your column. And he was a very big fan of yours and well respected you. And I've always wondered, did you go to law school or practice law before you became a columnist? And also, did you know Mr. Konevsky personally?
I didn't know him personally, but I read a famous book of his, and I followed him and respected him a lot. He wrote about a couple of my judicial heroes, Felix Frankfurter and Hugo Black, and people of opposite views, but both very, very strong-minded and learned. The answer to your first question is that I'm not a lawyer. I spent a year at the Harvard Law School as a fellow, playing law student. I was already a journalist, and I did that in order to become sufficiently able to cover the Supreme Court for the New York Times. But I did the work, I took the exams, and it had a profound effect on me. It really engraved the law onto me, I should say. Mm-hmm. Then I've become, this has really nothing to do with it, but I just feel like saying it.
Go for it.
I've been lucky enough to marry a lawyer who has become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, so I get my law at the highest level now.
Alvin, thanks for your call, and we'll savor that image of you reading to your blind law professor those years ago. We're at 1-800-423-8255, talking with Anthony Lewis, just retired columnist from the New York Times. Jack Beatty, you can hear this debate going in our calls already about whether there's something about the Constitution that we need to change. Anthony Lewis is standing up and saying no. In spite of all the shifting sands that we may be on right now, it's still the right document.
Yeah, well, that has been his message all these years, that if we set our course by that compass, we can't go wrong. It hasn't played us wrong. And when we look back at our history, it's the moments we've departed from it, even in wartime, that stand out, that we regret, that we look back upon with shame. And I think what he's saying now is, let's not look back upon this with shame. Let's not look back upon this as we do World War I, persecution of dissenters, World War II, the forcible removal of the Japanese, Vietnam, the spying, the lies, the abuse of power. Let's be proud of the way we fought this war.
Mm. Tony Lewis, assess the current moment for us in your rangefinder along those lines. How far off of even keel are we right now, or do you fear that we could get in this new, strange conflict compared to the examples in history that Jack cited?
Well, let me say first that I think the war has been fought extremely well,
mm-hmm.
better than anyone expected, and wisely. President Bush waited for weeks before he moved into the military phase. It's been very well judged, and it's been astoundingly successful. We can all agree on that.
No doubt.
I mean, I read the British press, and much of it was saying this is a terrible mistake, nothing will work, and of course they were completely wrong. But at the same time, I think perhaps in an initial understandable sense of panic at this horrible scene of the World Trade Center collapsing, we went overboard on the restrictions and this ghastly detaining of aliens who really had nothing to do with terrorism. And I think 99.9% of the cases and the writing of these executive orders, maybe as the war succeeds, I can have some hope of the panic subsiding and the rush into these shortcut methods going away. I hope that happens.
We'll hope so. We have to take a break. Anthony Lewis, stick with us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Anthony Lewis. He wrote his last column on the op-ed page of the New York Times last week after 50 years with the great gray lady. You can join our conversation with Tony Lewis tonight at 1-800-423-8255. He's covered great issues, but reminds us that it's a lot of fun doing it, and we're having fun talking with him tonight. Gary's on the line. Welcome, Gary. You're on the air.
Thank you. Mr. Lewis, I've been reading your columns ever since I graduated college. And I've taken you as one of the people who kept the eye on the compass. One of the questions I have is, how can the media fulfill its responsibility as a democratic institution when the government has become so skillful in assigning a role to it that it wants the media to play? For example, we seem to be getting all sorts of human interest stories about our brave soldiers and about the traitor American Taliban fighter, instead of the real issues of the war, which is, are we going to let thousands of Afghans starve every day throughout this winter because we've interrupted the flow of supplies and food to the villages. I've been looking for that information. It's darn hard to find, but it seems to me that's going to determine whether or not we're going to lose the war, and yet that isn't deemed newsworthy by the government, and how does the media fight that?
We got it, Gary. Anthony Lewis, what about
Gary,
it?
I think your question is a very good one, because the overwhelming desire and effectiveness of the government in enlisting the press on its side is very, very hard to resist. You're traveling with these people, whether it's the president or the secretary of defense, and it's chummy, and it goes to your head, fills you, your journalist's mind with ego, and so on. It's really tough. But I wouldn't take as negative a view of the particular question you asked as you did. That is, you suggested that the press wasn't paying sufficient attention to the desperate situation of the Afghan people and their imminent starvation and so on. The New York Times has had some really good stories from the scene suggesting that the next few days or weeks are crucial in whether we are going to see these people survive. And I haven't seen better coverage anywhere. I think it. I agree with you. It's terribly important, but I think our correspondents have been trying to do that job.
We've got callers who want to join us. Let's try and squeeze a couple more in. Irene is on the line. Welcome, Irene. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to say that I sure hope Mr. Lewis continues to write, even if it's just letters to the New York Times, which I hope they print, because the issue that I would like to see raised now is that the Constitution was framed by people who had won a guerrilla war. They had won in the same way that the Northern Alliance had won. And what they wrote does apply to the present situation. I don't think the Constitution should be changed. And I would like to hear somebody bring these issues of who it was that wrote the Constitution, what their previous careers were before they went to Washington, and what they left us with in their wisdom, you know, by the grace of God, basically.
Irene, thanks for your call. Tony Lewis, what about it? You write a lot about reason, and in your final column, the same. And the line in American history goes right back to the founders. Were they closer, more familiar, more intimate with reason than our leaders are today?
Well, I think Irene has a really important point. In fact, I meant to make it earlier myself to the caller who suggested that we're in a unique situation because of this devastating terrorist attack. Those people back in 1787, after all, it was only a short time, 11 years after the beginning of the War of Independence and a few years after that war ended. They knew war and dire conditions, and they felt as threatened then as we do now. This was a country of very primitive communications and transportation strung out along the Atlantic seaboard and at the mercy of larger powers. In fact, you know, the country was not very old, 1812, when the British marched into Washington and burned down the White House. So, you know, they were pretty desperate, but they still put their faith in reason. They really thought that a written document, nobody had ever even dreamt of this before, that a written document could hold politicians to honor, to honesty, and keep the country together. And they were philosophers. We were just lucky to have these sort of philosopher kings at our foundation.
So when an earlier caller suggested that the circumstance the United States is in now is outside the framers' imagination, you don't buy it.
No, that was Irene's point, and I agree with it strongly.
Anthony Lewis, we talked a little earlier, Jack Ray's, your comment in your parting interview with the Times, that you'd lost faith in the idea of progress. And that has just sat with me, and I've worked on it and worried about it over this last week. Where do you pin hope, if not on progress?
Well, you know, I have a view of responsibility rather than of hope. Of course, I hope a lot. I'm an optimist, and so I spend a lot of time hoping. You'd have to know that if I was a fellow who thought the Middle East conflict could be solved.
Yeah.
I still do, despite everything, because I think there is an example of terrible leadership, hopeless leadership on both sides. I just throw that in. But I think in a democracy and in these constitutional creations that have been happening all around the world since World War II, the responsibility is on the people to try to make things right, even if you don't have a sort of fatuous notion that progress is inevitable. That's what I meant by the idea of progress, that the inevitability of progress, I think that has been proved false. It isn't inevitable. You have to work at it. You really have to put your nose to the grindstone to make even little things happen. Just think of the effort that was put into ending, if it has ended, and I hope it has, the terrifying conflict in Northern Ireland. A lot of people in Britain, in the Irish Republic, and in Northern Ireland, and on both sides of that conflict, really took tremendous risks and devoted their lives to solving it. And that's what has to be done, not just the leaders, but the citizens. There's no other way, and if they do that, then there is hope of progress. It certainly isn't inevitable.
Anthony Lewis, our time is running down, but we take your parting thought. Just keep at it, and we wish you well, and we share Irene's hope that you will find new forums to share your thoughts with us as we all go forward.
I will, and I thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us tonight. Anthony Lewis just retired after 50 years with the New York Times, 32 years with his column Abroad at Home, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, and staunch defender of the United States Constitution. Jack Beatty, your thoughts on the meaning of this career?
Well, you know, I just wanted to talk about a couple of its features. First, his writing. I mean, Orwell, I think, characterized it when he talked about prose like a window pane. That's what we see with Anthony Lewis. No pyrotechnics, just the truth. Even the rhythms are the rhythms of sort of authenticity. Second, you know, to be an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, think of all the blandishments, all the invitations, all the great people who want to talk to you, all the sources who can prison you. This man has never sold out to anybody. Thirdly, he has been attacked and slandered even throughout his career, especially on the Middle East. And he has borne that, and he has dealt with that. And people have called him a traitor to the United States or something approaching that for his criticism of our government. And he stood up under that and never any whining about it, just staying by what he did so well. In a letter to the Times the other day, the writer Janet Malcolm said that his columns were, quote, a kind of enactment of the idea of rationality. Reason, yes, but also conscience. Did he make the world a better place? Who can say? What is certain is that he made his readers better people.
For Anthony Lewis, from Jack Beatty. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you. A pleasure.
To conclude this hour tonight, we have a special radio diary. Anthony Lewis reading his last column from last Saturday's New York Times.
Everything comes to an end, my friend Sidney Grusin told me long ago. Now the time has come for this column to end. I have been writing it for 32 years. As I look back at those turbulent decades, I see a time of challenge to a basic tenet of modern society, faith in reason. No one can miss the reality of that challenge after September 11. Islamic fundamentalism, rejecting the rational processes of modernity, menaces the peace and security of many societies. But the phenomenon of religious fundamentalism is not to be found in Islam alone. Fundamentalist Christians in America, believing that the Bible story of creation is the literal truth, question not only Darwin, but the scientific method that has made contemporary civilization possible. Religion and extreme nationalism have formed deadly combinations in these decades, impervious to reason. Serbs in the grip of religion and mystical nationalist history killed thousands and expelled millions in their ethnic cleansing of Bosnia. Fundamentalist Judaism and extreme Israeli nationalism have fed the movement to plant settlements in Palestinian territory, fueling Islamic militancy among Palestinians. Faith in reason was the foundation stone of the United States. The men who met in Philadelphia in 1787 set out to create a nation from struggling states so distant from each other that it took 7 days for George Washington to learn that New Hampshire had provided the needed ninth vote to bring their constitution into being. They wagered that a national government based on written rules could hold the country together. Intricate checks and balances, they reasoned, would prevent the abuses of power that tempt all politicians. They put their faith not in men, but in law, the law of the Constitution. Without the foundation of law, this vast country could never have survived as one, could never have absorbed streams of immigrants from myriad cultures. With one terrible exception, the Civil War, law and the Constitution have kept America whole and free. Of course, we have not always been faithful to the vision of the framers. In time of war and stress, we have yielded again and again to fear. Fear of Jacobin terror in France produced the Sedition Act of 1798. In World War I, men and women were sentenced to long prison terms for mildly critical political speech. In World War II, unreasoning fear led to the internment of Japanese Americans. During the Cold War, fear of communism brought the abuses of McCarthyism. Today again, fear threatens reason. Aliens are imprisoned for months on the flimsiest of grounds. The Attorney General of the United States moves to punish people on the basis of secret evidence, the Kafkaesque hallmark of tyranny. Recently, FBI agents went to a Houston art museum, and on suspicion that it was promoting terrorism, scrutinized a work that showed a city skyline burning. I am an optimist about America, but how can I maintain that optimism after Vietnam, after the murder of so many who fought for civil rights, after the Red Scare, and after the abusive tactics planned by government today? I can, because we have regretted our mistakes in the past, relearning every time that no ruler can be trusted with arbitrary power, and I believe we will again. The hard question is whether our commitment to law will survive the new sense of vulnerability that is with us all after September 11. It is easy to tolerate dissent when we feel safe. But after all, this has always been a country of unbounded optimism, a country that struggles with itself and conquers corrupting habit. In my lifetime, we have carried out two revolutions, unfinished but extraordinary: the ending of racial discrimination and the move toward equality for women. 32 years ago, few imagined that the Secretary of State could be anything but a white male. In a speech nearly a century ago, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. foresaw racial conflict and destruction of the world's resources. But even that great skeptic concluded, "Beyond the vision of battling races and an impoverished earth, I catch a dreaming glimpse of peace." In the end, I believe that faith in reason will prevail, but it will not happen automatically. Freedom under law is hard work. If rulers cannot be trusted with arbitrary power, it is up to citizens to raise their voices at injustice. The most important office in a democracy, Justice Louis Brandeis said, is the office of citizen.
Anthony Lewis, reading from his last column in this last Saturday's New York Times, entitled Hail and Farewell. To read the column, go to our website at wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. And we're always looking for your diary submissions. Send them by email. The address is special@wbur.org. We also want to hear about the music you may have turned to since September 11th for hope, to grieve, or to escape. Email us at special@wbur.org or call 617-358-0056. And make sure to let us know how to contact you for a future program. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.